If you turn to the 49th chapter of Genesis, there's a kind of blessing, and I think you could argue that the whole chapter is basically about blessings, but it's more than that. It does call it a blessing in verse 28 of the chapter. When he blessed them everyone with the blessing appropriate to him. So you think three times with blessing that there was quite clearly that was the emphasis. But it's not only blessing, because some of it is somewhat negative, and it's predicting, it's declaring what will come forth. And if nothing else is learnable from this chapter, at least we can understand that what the parents have been, or what the head of the tribe has been, is going to affect the whole of the tribe. And I don't mean just in some sort of disparate sort of way that we experience things in our modern life, but in life as it was intended to be, with this very strong family bodies and relationships which become tribes, there is a lot more to the corporate identity and effect of a body of people and the recognition of that solidarity than we normally appreciate in the Western world. We get it again, of course, when it comes to the new humanity in Christ. There is a solidarity in it, and what the head has done belongs to everybody else, even though they weren't there at the time. And it's a similar kind of impact on the tribes that flow from Israel. It's worth noting, too, that despite the fact that Moses did a heroic and magnificent job at bringing the peoples together as a nation, the tribes were the strongest units all the way through the history of Israel, until the 10 tribes were basically lost and just a few identified with Judah and Levi and Simeon down in the south. The main strength of Israel was in its tribes and its tribal structure. It might have something to say to us about the nature of the church, but it's just a passing thought. The nature of the church is very tribal. We have denominations and movements and streams and emphases and whatever, and maybe that is not such a terrible thing as some people make out. Even Catholicism, that boasts so-called a unity, if you look inside it, is absolutely teeming with variety and differences of opinion, but they sort of cover it up with a make-believe unity that headed up into the Pope. But the kind of unity that sometimes people are looking for is really belongs to a dream world. Amongst human beings, all of whom are less than infinite, it will always mean that there will be differences of approach and opinion, as full of variety as our faces are. And that does mean that there will be groupings of people or solidarities of which there is a unity reflecting the unity of the totality, but is a unity of itself which has an impact to make along a particular line. So I don't think that we should be surprised. Now, I know this is a kind of a rationale or a beginning of a rationale for, if you like, a doctrine of denominations, one of which is a name that's virtually hated by new churches, and one of which is sadly accepted by the historic churches. But I wonder whether we've got it all wrong, and that we ought to really be rejoicing in our different streams and expressing a unity over and above that, but taking the variety and the richness that comes that God intends. Anyway, God didn't seem to have any problem about tribes, and here the tribes are being blessed, and Jacob is blessing all these in the 49th chapter. But as I say, it's more than blessing, it's also predictive. And the head of that particular movement is demonstrated as having an effect upon what comes further down the stream. Then Jacob summoned his sons and said, "Assemble yourselves that I may tell you what will befall you in the days to come." So it is predictive at the beginning. It's called a blessing three times at the end. Blessing has already been the prerogative of Jacob. He stood before Pharaoh and blessed Pharaoh. Now that is the basic principle from Genesis, is that the lesser is blessed by the greater. And that's the Melchizedek, isn't it? That Abraham was blessed by Melchizedek, and Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek. And here is Pharaoh blessing, being blessed by Jacob. Now, obviously there's some degree of the respect given to age, as Jacob somewhat quaintly says, 100 and whatever it was years have been full of trial and troubles and so forth. And then he blesses Pharaoh to sort of encourage him, I suppose. But Pharaoh accepts it. And I just want to say this in passing, because it's worth bearing in mind when we do bless people and when we exercise blessing. It's much easier as you get older to bless people, because people accept it. But I've noticed that, how can I put it without being too negative? When you pray for somebody and you want to bless them, remember it's a great privilege to bless them, because there is always the danger that you're taking authority over them. And that can lead to a place where you are, in a sense, trying to bond people. And this does happen, to try and bond people to yourself. So I would say, you know, take it lightly. And don't rush in as though you've got all the rights in the world to go and bless somebody, especially somebody who's twice your age. There is a place to show a certain degree of restraint and concern, that you are not just dominating and liking the idea of control. So bear that in mind as you seek to bless people and pray for them. So but of course, as a man of Jacob's years and dealing with his own sons, there's a natural and proper respect that's given and an acceptance of the blessing that he's going to bring. Some of the things he says to his sons are very, very strong. And even though, shall we say, Benjamin might have been one of the favorites, look at Benjamin, for instance, in 49, and, well, he's right at the end, verse 27. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf, or a wolf that tears. In the morning he devours the prey. In the evening he divides the spoil. That's all he's got to say about Benjamin. And yet Benjamin was the one that would have broken his heart, and he would have gone down to his grave if he'd lost him. So he's not just prophesying out of, well, I can see it this way or feel it this way, and this is my interpretation of what it ought to be or what it feels like. He's actually receiving from God and saying what's coming from the Lord. And of course we know very well that Benjamin, the little bit that we do find out about him as a tribe, was pretty disastrous over that whole business of, you know, the raping of the concubine, and then the way which violently the man cut the woman up and sent bits around, and the tribes of Israel rose up in indignation and attacked Benjamin, and then Benjamin fought it out and they got decimated and lost most of their males. And you know, they were a pretty ferocious and antagonistic bunch. They weren't going to let anybody push them around. So Benjamin is fulfilling, if you like, in the tribe, what was being said by this word that Jacob had. However, let's go back and start at the beginning, verse 2. Gather together. Oh, sorry, I was also going to point out, and of course also the blessing of the separate sons of Joseph, Manasseh and Ephraim. And you remember he crosses his hands, and the younger one gets the bigger blessing, and the first blessing, and the blessing has gone there. So Jacob, having reached the years of his life where he's gone through so many trials and so many experiences, is in the place where he can bless. And as I say, the height of it is when he blesses Pharaoh, I suppose. So here he is bringing forth words from the Lord. Gather together and hear, O sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel your father. So this is like a rather nice way of calling them into together to receive. The first is the firstborn, Reuben. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength. You might say that that's a wonderful statement to make about his firstborn. It's the expectancy that a great deal of energy and activity would come out of his firstborn. He put a lot of hope in where he might go and what he might be. You're my firstborn, my might, the beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. So here's the emphasis on the firstborn, that it means preeminence. It means preeminence in dignity, which is not a bad thing if it's properly carried. A preeminence in power, which very often is corrupting, even though it may be good power. preeminent in power. Now, that is the ideal and the calling of the firstborn. And you could use that as a basis for explaining what it means to be the firstborn church. The church is the church of the firstborn, do you remember? In Hebrews chapter 12. You could therefore say the calling is this preeminence in dignity, preeminence in power. But in verse 4, uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence. Now we know that Christ must have the preeminence. And if we give Christ preeminence, then we share with him in the age to come. Uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence. Because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went into Bilhah, who was one of the, well, the maids of the maid of Leah, and this woman was taken also by the son. Now that is confusion. Always remember that adultery is just mixture. Mixture and confusion are the things that, as much as sexual activity, are the things which are spoken against in all this chaos that exists in breaking up the structures of family. And it's the case today. It's not just simply that sexual activity is taking place, it's because it brings confusion. You don't know whose child is whom's. And you don't know, in many so-called families today, which child comes from which father. And the confusion such is that every child, or nearly 90% as they grow up, want to know, who was my father? It's just something innate that God has put within the human being. And they want to know where they came from. They want to find their identity by discovering their father. But you can't in the kind of chaos that ensues when all the family channels get broken down. And so what is happening here is a complete chaos that he goes into his father's wife, as it were. And that is, although he's a stepson, of course, to her, but it is something which is confusion. Because you went to your father's bed, then you defiled it. And then Jacob, as it were, turns to the other sons, and he goes from the second person to the third person. Up to then, he's been talking directly to Reuben. Now he turns and he says, he went up to my couch, as though he's turning to the other sons who are all around there waiting for their blessing. And Jacob is appealing to them. See, he went up to my couch, in the third person. It's perhaps a sense of outrage and revulsion that Jacob felt. And it's coming out at this point. Now, there are many times when Jacob, because of his own sin and disobedience to God and using the flesh and his own resources, there are times when Jacob can't discipline his children. This is always something coming up in Scripture because of their own lifestyle and the things they've done. But at this point, it's as though towards the end of his life, he's making one last valiant attempt. Well, I might not have been able to keep the next two, for instance, Simeon and Levi, in order. And I possibly let go much too easily and cheaply the terrible thing they did for our family and the name of our family. But at last, at the end of my life, at least I'm going to make some sort of attempt to point out that this is something which wasn't acceptable. So, sad as it may be that it's towards the end of his life, at least it's a part of at least a character building expression at the end of his life. Now let's go back again. The calling for the firstborn is for preeminence. I would say that corresponds in the New Testament. The calling of the firstborn church is to reign with Christ. It is to share the preeminence of Jesus in the age to come. However, Reuben lost his birthright. And even though he is not named in Hebrews, he is put alongside Esau. Esau sold his birthright. Reuben lost his birthright. And I would say that because it says, not being as a fornicator, that's Reuben, or Esau, who sold his birthright. I would think it's 99% almost sure that the writer of the Hebrews could have said, not like Reuben and not like Esau. But then he would have to explain Reuben, and as he has to explain Esau, because he sold his birthright. But both of them were firstborns, and both of them lost the privilege and the right that was their calling. And the church is called into preeminence to reign with Christ. We are called a firstborn church, but we can lose our firstborn rights, just like he did. Now that's what, if I took up Reuben on Sunday morning, that's what I would emphasize, that he is reflective of what the church is and what the church is called to. And he lost it simply because of sheer selfish indulgence and lust. And whether it's eating something or whether it was sexual activity, just throwing it all away. Reigning with Christ is always contingent. And I understand it that although, just like the calling of Israel was to come out of Egypt and to go into the Promised Land, with many who came out of Egypt, they did not go into the Promised Land. The calling of the church is to abide in Christ and bring forth fruit and gain the prize. But a prize is to be gained, and sometimes you lose it. Just like the Apostle Paul says that he wants to, having preached to others, not be disqualified. In other words, throw away that privilege. And he wants to, you know, he wants to run hard to gain the prize. Now it's that I believe that is there, and I think a lot of us in the church will not gain our first, will not hold on to our destiny in this sense. We will be in eternity, but not in eternity with the preeminence that is promised to the firstborn. You see the idea? In the New Testament, it's an individual thing, yes. And I think as it's spoken of course, it is particularly individual, because it's what Reuben did as an individual. But the impact as the father of this tribe is that it gives a disadvantage to the tribe to actually being what God would have wanted for them. And it's just like it could be that the tribes, well, this is stretching the analogy, but the tribal leaders who came out of Egypt could have been the people who bring discouragement to their own people, to their own tribe, and so everybody's affected by their defection. That's why it's so important, you know, whether it's a national church, whether it's a local church, whether it's your family, that what we are as the heads of the little bits that we are the heads of and affecting, that what streams from us as the source, head, not so much authority but source, what comes from us as source is that which is blessing and is stimulating to the highest degree and not giving a disadvantage, as it were, to the ethos and the common environment which conditions us and disadvantages us. And that's why these blessings and the are so important. And why in Genesis there, and of course later in Deuteronomy, there's so much of it. And if you go back even to the story of Noah, when he comes out of a drunken stupor and virtually curses his grandson on account of what he thought about his son, when it was his fault anyway that he was drunk, you know, it's what I think the text is showing is not some great purposes which God majestically has ordained that this should live in the tents of Shem and be blessed and all this sort of stuff, and the misuse it's been given concerning people of a different culture and a different coloured skin out of terrible exegesis. But nonetheless, it does show that what we do, whether out of drunken stupors or not, is going to affect down the line history. And that is the serious and fearful thing about being a human being. And it's that aspect, I think, that comes out in these blessings, and starting in Genesis with Noah and then going right on and here the tribes. I would think then that the uncontrolled as water, you will not have the preeminence. I wrote down a couple of verses, Numbers 16. Yes, that's right, that was a reminder to me. The Reuben's people later largely joined up with the rebellion of Dathan and Korah. Numbers 16 verse 1. And so again, you see, none of us can live without affecting each other, and it just so happens that blood being thicker than water, that the family impact is a colossal one. But in Numbers chapter 16 verse 1, now Korah, the son of Izhar and the son of Kohath and the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and so forth. And then the son of on the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took action, and they rose up before Moses. So Reuben was involved, or a certain section of the Reubenites, with this rebellion, which led them to destruction. So it's that uncontrollableness, uncontrolled as water. He shall not have the preeminence. It's that which is particularly judged here. Acting without due regard and just as your emotions would take you up and motivate you. In fact, the word uncontrolled in verse 4 is in the margin of the NASB is boiling over or reckless. It's been translated unruly by some people. So, unruly, reckless, wild, boiling over. I mean, the whole thing you get about it is that is somebody totally ill-disciplined. And discipline is what Jacob should have given his children. And because he didn't give them, it's opened the door for this kind of letting loose of his emotions at any moment, which led him astray with Bilhah, and then losing his preeminence. We're in the 49th chapter of Genesis. So that's just a suggestion to you, and the way that I haven't made up my mind on Sunday morning which one of these, because there's so many of them that I would take up. But that would give a very good starting off ground, which is not just making use of them, of the verses. It is, I think, obviously endemic to the whole movement of God that this concept exists and is going to find its full flower in the church. And we need, therefore, to identify it and isolate it and judge it. That we want that out of our lives. We want it out of the influences that we give people. We want it out of the example that we give those who are around us, that we might call our spiritual family or tribe, in order that we may be a people who really do achieve the prize and don't, or like it says in Colossians, just another explanation of that, that we were reconciled through the blood. We were reconciled in order that he might present us holy and without blame. If we continue in the faith, we have been reconciled, we will be presented. We have been reconciled, and that is fixed. We will be presented if we continue in the faith. And so the gaining of the prize, the attaining to what the preeminence that is prophesied here, the place of authority, is something which is to be not thrown away. It was our destiny, but we can throw it away. Enough said, but I think that is a rich one, the first one, for development, in if you want to spend even the whole morning on it. The second one, Simeon and Levi, funny enough, are being blessed together. They acted together in a terrible story. The story was the fact that Dinah was seduced by one of the members of one of the Canaanites living there, and when the man wanted to marry her, but they wouldn't even countenance it, and went in. Well, first of all, they said that they were to be circumcised, and then when they were disadvantaged, they move in and they destroy them. I mean, an appalling act of vengeance. Forgive me for making a parallel, but it's with all due respect to the wickedness that exists in Al-Qaeda and the Hassan and all that's going on in Israel. The kind of viciousness that this depicts shows its characteristic that, of course, we're all able to do, but it does illustrate very much the appalling kind of violence that these two Israelites were willing to take up. So Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly. Now, Jacob there is trying to disassociate himself from his sons. Rightly so, but on the same time, again, how much responsibility did he have? Why was he sitting by? Well, it's all very well to be clever after the event, because you can imagine a couple of very these are full grown men. They've decided to abandon any reference to their father and the honour of the family. And as a matter of fact, you remember Jacob said, "You've made my name to stink." And he could feel the opprobrium that's coming upon them all as a family because of the action of these two boys, or these two men. You shouldn't call them boys, they were fully grown, they knew what they were up to. "Simeon and Levi are brothers, their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their counsel." So he's trying to keep his soul apart from what they had done. Now it is very difficult when you live in close relationship, either in a family or in the family of the church, to keep outside actions which you are so easily seduced into yourself. Jacob easily could have gone along, "Yeah, well, okay, they deserved it. Yeah, I understand you boys. Yeah, I realize they've got what they are." And you enter in, especially if people are trying to evoke it from you and are giving you leading questions, and before you know where you are, because you've approached it in a kind of sanguine fashion, you're agreeing with them, and your own soul gets contaminated. Your soul enters into their counsel. And then you can't draw back. You've gone too far along the line, smiling and saying, "Yes, isn't it nice?" And now you're shocked. Was that really what it really... And it's too late. You're a part of it. And Jacob is trying to do that in his own soul. Then when it goes on to say, "Let not my glory be united with them," it could be that that word glory is very close to the word liver, which is the way that the Septuagint understands it. And of course the liver was the seat of the emotions. So possibly he is saying, "Don't let my emotions be united with their assembly," which doesn't make a lot of difference as the actual psychological action that's going on. Just as your soul can enter into counsel, so through your emotions, or through your, if you like, your sense of euphoria, of glory, you can move into the corporate feeling. This is emphasizing the emotional side, whether you translate liver or whether you translate glory. It's entering into the emotions of an assembly. It is the effect that other people have around us. Now, of course, these psychological and sociological experiences, phenomena, can be used for good. When you are with good people, you find goodness is drawn out of you and you want to be better. When you're with bad people, you find that they are drawing you into their counsel and into their emotions. And if you've never experienced that, then you haven't really lived long. It goes on all the time. And it's very hard sometimes when you found you've gone down the line with somebody a little way, and then in order to come back, obviously you have to make a break, and it seems rude. And you don't want to be rude, and you want to be well liked, and so you go on a bit further with them. That is the kind of pressure that comes from an assembly, or from council, or from our discussions and our lives and work together. And to keep one's soul clear before God is the important thing, but to use that for a good end in order to influence others and draw them into good things and not bad things is the way in which we were meant to be using this particular experience that God gives us, is being human. Now these two obviously joined in the council, they've acted in a way and egged each other on, and Jacob is trying to disassociate from that in his own life as he gets towards the end of his life. "Because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen." Now that's a slightly different one, difficult one. It could be, because we don't read at the time that they went round and slaughtered all these people from, was it Shechem? Let's go and have a look at it. It's in Genesis 34, thank you. "Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land. And when Shechem," that's right, I thought it was Shechem, "the son of Hamor, the Hivite, and the prince of the land, saw her, he took her and lay with her by force. And he was deeply attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to the father Hamor, saying, 'Get me this young girl for wife.' Now Jacob heard that he had defied Dinah, his daughter, but his sons were with his livestock in the field, so Jacob kept silent until they came in. Then Hamor, the son of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. And now the sons of Jacob came in from the field, and when they heard it, the men were grieved. They were very angry, because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not to be done. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage, and intermarry with us, and give your daughters to us, and take our daughters for yourselves. And thus you shall live with us, and the land will be open for you. Live and trade in it, and acquire property in it." Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers, "If I find favor in your sight, then I will give whatsoever you say to me. Ask me so much bridal payment, etc., etc." And Jacob's sons answered Shechem, because he had defiled Dinah, the sister, they say, "We cannot do this thing, to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised." So he gets them to be circumcised. And then it came about on the third day, verse 25, when they were in pain, the two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came into the city unawares and killed every male. And they killed Hamor, the son of Shechem, with the edge of the sword. They took Dinah from Shechem's house and went forth. And Jacob's sons came upon the slain and looted the city because they had defiled their sister. And they took their flocks and their herds and their donkeys and that which was in the city and that which was in the field. And they captured and looted all their wealth and all the little ones and their wives, even all that was in the house, in the houses. And Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You've brought trouble on me, making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and Perizzites, my men being few in number. They will gather together against me, and they will attack me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my household." They said, "Should he treat our sister as a harlot?" Even there you can see Jacob's character coming out, can't you? It was all, "Poor old me, I'm going to get it in the neck," rather than that this was a wrong thing to do before God. Now, the whole point of going back and just reading that was to remind myself that they did take the animals and so on, but it doesn't say anything about the laming of them. Verse 6, "And in their self-will they lamed oxen." They hamstrung them, probably. Now, if you did that, you've still got your oxen, but they're no good for labor. They can't pull anything. Or is it just a metaphorical allusion to the chief men in Shechem? In this group, Shechem and the others, Hamor and so forth. Are these people just referred to as ones that were completely paralyzed and finished off laming the oxen, the strong men? I don't know. Or is it that they did take the animals but did that to them anyway, but we don't know anything about it? But whatever, it is again the idea of violence, aggressive violence coming out. Now, this is supposed to be a blessing, but here is Jacob saying, "Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel." Then, as though he were in the place of God, but he's probably doing it in the sense that God will do it through him, "I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." Of course, obviously, centuries later, it's God that does any dispersing, it's God that does any scattering, but it's as though coming through the mouth of Jacob, "I will do it. I, the Lord, say to you," kind of idea, like we do sometimes in prophecy. So he's speaking of their dispersing and scattering. Simeon was not only dispersed, Simeon was virtually lost as time went on into Judah. As a tribe, it just sort of went out of existence. Levi was scattered because they were to serve the whole of Israel, and the Levites were scattered all over Israel and didn't exist any longer as a solidarity. So the impact, the negative impact that these brothers had into their tribal situations in the end destroys the tribe. Or with Levi, it's not so much that it's destroyed, but it doesn't function as a tribe. It functions as individuals associated with other tribes. So there is an ongoing impact made through their activity, and it's helped on, we might say, by the cursing of the father. Jacob cursed them for their anger. "I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." Now, a fascinating prophecy, isn't it? It's fascinating cursing, not a blessing. Then comes Judah. That's the youngest of Leah, isn't it, Judah? And so we had the four children of Leah here, or were there two more later on? Forgotten. Anyway. Judah, your brother, shall praise you. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion. And as a lion or a lioness, who dares rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the people. He ties his foal to the vine, his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine, his robes are the blood of grapes. His eyes are dulled from wine, his teeth white from milk. Now that is a very, very rich, as far as the New Testament is concerned, a prophecy. And of course Judah is going to be so important as a tribe, as the tribe through which our Lord Jesus Christ comes. So let's look at it more closely. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. That is playing on the word Judah. He was called Judah because Leah praised God. And so she called her son when he was born, so she called him Praise. But notice, your brothers shall praise you. Judah, your brothers shall Judah you. Praise, your brothers shall praise you. That's the sort of play on words there. Now this is exactly what Paul takes up in Romans chapter 2. He says, it is not so much the circumcision in the body, it is the circumcision of the heart, and it is not so much being a Jew whose praise is of men, but a Jew whose praise is of God. He actually takes up this idea, not so much of the brothers praising, but of men praising, and of men acknowledging. It's not, that isn't the point, says Paul. Paul says that the real Judah, the real Jew, is the one whose praise is from God. So this is the grounds upon which Paul, quite rightly, can move this huge theological shift, that he can move from centuries of Israelism, you might say, to a point where now the Gentiles are acknowledged and can come in. And he does it on the ground of this somewhat obscure, you might think, verse in Genesis, in the words that were blessed upon Judah. It's on exactly the same lines of the play on words that is given not only at Judah's birth, but at the prophecy that goes all the way through his tribe. So there's a solidarity in the tribe of Judah, which then expresses itself as blessing to the Gentiles by the time we reach Romans 2. Here it says, who's got the praise of his brothers. There is, whose praise is not of men, but of God. And that is the difference. You get your praise of your brothers, because I'm a Jew, and I'm a Jewish brother, and I'm a part of the Jewish system, and I'm a part of the Jewish family, and so my brothers praise me. Just like, presumably, sadly, Jews are backing up Jews in Israel today, and Palestinians are backing up Palestinians, and the British back up the British, and the Bush camp back up the Bush camp, and the Clinton camp back up the Clinton camp. It is something of being human that these things happen. But it's not the praise of your brothers that you are Jewish, it is the praise of God that you are a human being who is seeking to keep the requirements of the law. Got the idea? And this is the basis upon which Paul does it. There are, one of these days I'd like to pick out all these nuances, but do you remember the one where I pointed out the one and only place in Genesis where the seed is clearly seen to be singular and not plural? And when it says that he shall defend his, or fight off the enemies in his gate, and it's the singular. Paul takes that singular and uses it in Galatians, and builds a whole thing about it, that there is only really one seed of Abraham, but then goes on to say, but because you're all sons of Abraham by faith, because by faith in the one seed. And you could easily overlook it. And then again here, in the business of inheriting the land forever, that shows, as the writer of the Hebrews develops it, that it was not just simply the land of Canaan. It was something that was going to be forever and ever and ever, which would have to go through the resurrection, the regeneration, the eternal ages, and so on and so forth. and therefore the promise was to be fulfilled on a higher level, you might say, of a heavenly world rather than just simply a patch of ground in Canaan. But that's just a little hint there in all the promises given about the land. That's why Abraham looked for a city whose builder and maker was God. He was looking for a blessing beyond just the earthly one. And those little nuances and hints, here's another one, and one of them, are terribly important when you get to the New Testament, because they're all being exploited, as it were, by interpretation and opening up to the Gentiles and to eternity. It's lovely, isn't it? I think so, anyway. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. It's usually the foot, but we do find it in other writings. The hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your, in fact, very often, unfortunately, we fathers get to that with our kids, don't we? It's much easier to grab them by the neck if they're going to do something wrong, you know, and pull them back. I always remember the story that, you know, because nobody can tell the story like Gerald would tell it, but how he was so frustrated with his son one day that he grabbed him and marched out of the lift that they were in. They were in a shop and they were going up in the lift, and he got this boy by the hand and he marched him out like this to tell him off, and he got the wrong boy. It was so it was somebody else's son, and his kid was, you know, absolutely staggered. And but you can imagine that Gerald would have taken 15 minutes to tell you that, and you'd have laughed all the way through. But there we are. Your hair will be on the neck of your enemies, and your father's son shall bow down to you, which of course is fulfilled in the days when David becomes the king, and the father's sons, the other tribes, will bow down to him. And all the tribes come under Judah in the end. Judah is a lion's whelp. Now, verse 9 has got three different words for lion. One is a lion's whelp, that's a young one and active. From the prey, my son, you've gone up. That might mean you've grown up, actually. By eating the prey, you've grown strong. So you start off with a lion's whelp, eating the prey, getting stronger. He couches and lies down as a lion. So he's having had his food and grown up, you might say. He doesn't fear anybody. He goes back to his den. In the den, he lies down because he doesn't think anybody's going to frighten him. And, you know, lions are not all forever looking around, are they? They're superior, and anything's going to come along, they don't bother to stir themselves to the last minute and just then zap you. So in confidence, he's lying there, he couches, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who dares rouse him up? In fact, this time it's probably lioness. They're three slightly different words. Well, of course, it is the lioness more maybe than the lion, who, when, if anything's going to affect her young or invade the den where the family is held, she will fight like anything to keep her young. And so there's a ferocity that is expressed there. The ruler, that Judah, the ruler, as it's going to come out in a minute, who has got all this strength and which the sons bow down to, is now being depicted as a lion. Well, now you know the New Testament allusion again. The lion of the tribe of Judah. And Jesus is the final expression, you might say, of this lion-likeness of Judah. See, it's absolutely packed full with New Testament allusions here. And the lion of Judah, though, is not one that is going to, by its ferocity, overcome. But I looked for the lion of Judah and I saw one as a lamb standing, but has the strength to rise up out of death itself and stand there to reign. And the reigning lion is like a lamb in the way that his touch brings authority into the world. So that's fulfilled. The next part's an interesting verse, not always easily translatable. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. The scepter, of course, was a symbol of authority and rulership. The ruler's staff between his feet was be that staff you just put between your feet as you were sitting there making judgments. It was a symbol of your authority, and you'd hold it with your feet and it would lean over your shoulder. The ruler's staff between his feet. Until Shiloh comes. This has been variously translated, the vowels taken out, and it's been retranslated because the vowels weren't in the original Hebrew, and there's been a lot of attempts to try and be finally definitive, which is probably not possible, as to what this actual sentence should translate as. If we stick to it as most translations do, I don't think we're far off the truth. Until Shiloh comes, or if you've got the margin of the NASB there, you'll see it says, until he who comes, to whom it belongs. There does seem to be something of the possessiveness about this statement. The one to whom it belongs comes. I don't think it's got anything to do with Shiloh, which was a meeting place way back in the later days of Israel. It is a name and a title. If you would turn to Ezekiel 21 for a minute, and verse 26, maybe we have an Old Testament follow-up to this ancient verse. Verse 26 says, but the more perhaps interesting allusion is if we look at Galatians chapter 3, verse 9, where virtually the same phrase is used. 3 verse 19. Galatians 3:19. Why the law then? It was added because of transgressions, having been ordained through angels by the agency of a mediator, until the seed who should come, or till the seed should come, or to the seed who should come, to whom the promise had been made, and to whom it should belong. The promise was made that this is yours, that the future age and the salvation of mankind and so on, to whom it belonged, to whom the promise had been made. Now that he should come is just a clear parallel with the Septuagint translation back here in 49 of Genesis. But there is a verse in Ezekiel, and I'll have to check it out, both of which have, as it were, drawn upon this original statement, until Shiloh comes. And here is Paul saying, until he who to whom it belongs comes. He who comes to whom it belongs. And the probably there in the original text of Genesis, what belongs is the rulership, it's the kingship. It's the scepter and the staff between his feet. Well, now, Judah didn't seem to rule all the time until Jesus came, obviously. They all went into exile. But it seems to be saying that there is always somebody there who, in Judah, who is providing a continuity until the time would come when the one to whom it belongs would come and take it. See the idea? So although the kings of Judah in title finished at the exile, even Zerubbabel, who was the leader when they came back, is of the line of Judah again, and the kings still continue through those lines. And then eventually, of course, Jesus. So the scepter is there for somebody to come and collect it, and to he to whom it belongs will come. And then it says, to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. Now I think it's fascinating. Again, it says, to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. We're moving out from Israel. We're breaking out from some kind of elitist nation position to carry on into all the peoples. But that is so close to the phrase that is used at the beginning of Romans and the end of Romans, where Paul talks about the obedience of faith for all the nations, or to all the nations, or for all the peoples. And here you've got the reference here, in again, just an allusion. As I say, it's another one of those little nuances that I like to put down in a book one day. I just never get to it, will I? But here's a nuance again. The obedience of faith to all the nations, the obedience of the peoples. Romans chapter 1 verse 5, and also Romans chapter 16, forgotten the verse towards the end, last couple of verses. Now we go into another phase. Once he who has come to take the authority and the kingship and the scepter and the staff which has been kept in Judah and is now reigning with it, and the obedience of all the peoples beyond Israel is starting to take place, and those who have got praise from God, not just those who got praise from their brothers, are joining in, and there are those who are bowing down and acknowledging him, a new age has dawned. And the new age is now described. He ties his foal to the vine. You do not do that sort of thing. A vine is going to crack and break if you tie an animal to it. Ray Mayhew and I have a long-standing joke about how I pretended I was affronted and outraged because he came one day in the days when he was fitter, bless him, because he couldn't do it now, riding his bicycle, and he actually chained his bicycle up to the vine that's in the front of my house. You don't do that sort of thing. Somebody jumps on the bike and rides off, that vine is finished. And it's a brittle kind of wood, isn't it? The vine wood. So, but you do it if you've got so many vines, you don't bother. And that's what's being implied here. That the donkey is tied up, or the foal is tied up to the vine, because there's so many of them. It's used as a kind of a hitching post. Which, vines are not meant to be used for hitching posts for animals. But we've got so many, it doesn't matter. His donkey's colt to the choice vine. Even the vine that's turning out really special wine, like the Spätwürzer and that sort of thing. A special vine is being tied up to a donkey. He washes his garments in wine. Not just going around water and wash your garments. We've got so much wine, then we're going to wash our garments in it. His robes in the blood of grapes. So that's a kind of parallelism of Jewish poetry. We've got so much of the grape juice. There's so many grapes around. It's a terrific harvest time. We can use it for washing. Let's put it in the washing machine and keep it running. We don't need water. His eyes are, now it says dull. I think probably dark is better from wine. And his teeth white from milk. And that last phrase is a little bit surprising, because we've had verse 11 vine, verse 11 vine, verse 11 wine, verse 11 grapes, verse 12 wine. It's all to do with wine, and suddenly we've got a drop of milk coming in. So it's rather surprising, but I don't know how else it could be translated. So, but
here at the bottom of the NSB it says darker than wine and whiter than milk.
Yes, I think that's what's implied by it, yes.
The idea of dull from wine gives the impression of new drunk.
Exactly. I was going to come to that. Yes. And that the dullness is not the best way of understanding it. It is the darkness. In other words, your teeth are so brilliantly white and your eyes are so dark and piercing and alive. That's what's meant to be taken out of the text. Not that you've got a drunken sop who's having a drop of milk because his teeth are so rotten. So the whole thing from verse 11 and verse 12 is simply spelling out the luxurious new age that is to dawn. The affluence and the fecundity that is bursting forth, so that wine and milk, as you know, land flowing milk and honey, is so available. It's pouring out. And we are drinking so much, they probably rightly so thought that a lot of milk would help you anyway. But it's either used as a literal thing or as is translated here as a comparison, teeth whiter than milk and eyes darker than wine. But it shows the health and the life of the people living in this new age. Now it's interesting that the description of the new age is largely, almost exclusively, in terms of wine. And the first miracle that Jesus did was to change water into wine, because the new age has dawned. The wine is beginning to flow. And of course, he also was interested in a foal, a donkey's colt, and rode into Jerusalem on it, another symbol of the new age. Behold, your king comes to you, meek and lowly, riding on an ass, the colt, the foal of an ass. And here it is, tied up to the fecundity of the new age. Now, aren't these symbols and things wonderful, all just hooked into each other very quietly, as it were, not making a song and a dance, and the whole picture is beginning to develop, which is drawn out, and in the New Testament developed in such wonderful ways. Of course, you could go on and talk about that wine that Jesus changed the water to wine is in the Lord's table. Do this in remembrance of me. Well, this is the age in which we live now. It's the wine and milk age, you could argue, but at least it's the wine age of luxury. Because the Lion of Judah is reigning. Got the idea? So, I mean, you could spend all morning on that one, couldn't you? Do you like that one? You can take your choices of these. The next ones are a bit shorter until we get to Joseph. Zebulun shall dwell at the seashore. He shall be a haven for ships and his flank towards Sidon. In actual fact, he dwelt not so much at the seashore, but towards the seashore. And he was he didn't actually have access to the Mediterranean, but towards it. And his flank towards Sidon would again be that they would use the ports, though, along that part for trade and for enrichment. And so really it's just simply saying Zebulun's in a good position for trade and therefore prosperity. And again, it might just be wanting to continue with the idea of the new age of prosperity that shall arise. There could be, if you took the trouble to do a lot of research, you could take up the times where these different tribes appear and draw out different aspects that their history might demonstrate what's been prophesied here. You remember that in the New Testament, Zebulun is mentioned in Matthew chapter 4. The land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali, the way of the sea beyond Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who were sitting in darkness saw a great light. Those who were sitting in the land of the shadow of death, upon them light dawns. Is it significant that Zebulun and Naphtali, who are coming up, I think Naphtali's next, is it, or a bit further on, that these are both insignificant tribes that seem to contribute very little, but they have the promise that in their littleness and insignificance and their mixture even with the Gentiles, Galilee of the Gentiles, that it's there that the light first shone. That'll come up again as we look at Naphtali in a moment. So Zebulun shall dwell by the seashore, shall be a haven for ships, his flank shall be towards Sidon, is an indication of the blessing that he should have received from his position and has received when Jesus came from its position in the north in Galilee and his ministry there. Issachar is a strong donkey lying down between, not the sheepfolds perhaps, although donkeys could lie between the sheepfolds for a bit of protection on a cold night, but is much more likely to be the saddlebags, as it's got in the margin, because it's to do again with the idea of donkeys carrying goods and carrying commerce on their saddlebags that hang over a donkey. That's how you load them up. When he saw that a resting place was good and that the land was pleasant, he bowed his shoulder to bear burdens and became a slave at forced labor. His freedom was exchanged for materialism, and that is the case for Issachar. He was dominated and taken over by those cities, Tyre, Sidon, and so on, in order to give access to trade, although I think that they did actually touch into the sea coast, but they traded it and they became slaves at forced labor, in verse 15. But the land was pleasant and it's a resting place, and we got plenty of resources coming in on the saddlebags of these donkeys. So Issachar is like a donkey serving and ultimately serving others in a forced way, although they gain a lot out of it. It's a little bit like Reuben starts off with all his strength and then finishes off in being, as it were, judged. Here's Issachar starts off. This is your calling, to be a strong donkey, but you finish up by, laziness, but lead you into becoming a slave. Dan, verse 16 to 18, Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. So amongst the tribes of Israel, Dan was given a calling to be a judge. But again, he fails in his calling. The reality is, Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a horned snake in the path that bites the horse's heels, so that his rider falls backwards. So instead of using it in an honourable and dignified way, his calling to be a judge becomes simply somebody who's sniping and biting and bringing people down, even from behind them, biting the horse's heels. The ability to see what is good and what is evil is not always, because the tree of knowledge of good and evil, as you know, is not always the best attribute to have, because you may misuse it. You can misuse your discernment of what's right and wrong and govern people and condition them and make use of them. And Dan eventually goes right out of the scene and doesn't appear in the book of Revelation. He's disappeared altogether. Perhaps the warning is, although you've got to have a Dan around, and sometimes you've got to be a Dan yourself, you have to judge. Yet how you judge is the way you will be judged. So the warning is, judge not, that you be not judged, but with what judgment you judge, it will be meted to you again. He's misusing his ability to judge by backbiting or heel biting, as it is here. It's interesting the word heel is used in verse 17 and again in verse 19, because it belongs to the name of Jacob, doesn't it? Who laid hold of the heel of his brother. Perhaps he's thinking about his own experience of being a bit duplicitous, and he's worrying about Dan and he's worrying about Gad in verse 19. But then suddenly in verse 18 he bursts out, "For your salvation I wait, O Lord." Perhaps by mentioning the heels he's thinking, yeah, and I need salvation, I need help. Left to myself, I haven't got any hope. I wait for your salvation, O Lord. Or maybe he's praying it for Dan. Dan's going to be absolutely hopeless and is going to act in this treacherous kind of way. As a reality, he doesn't come up to his calling. So I'm going to pray for him, your salvation. I'm waiting for your salvation for Dan, O Lord. This is the first mention of salvation in the Bible. And Jacob is said to be waiting for it. We know it comes in Christ. We know also when he comes again that salvation appears. Well, it's already appeared, but it will appear again. He will come without sin, but with salvation. And also in Titus, the salvation has appeared unto all men. So it's the Lord that he's praying for here. For your salvation I wait. For Jesus I wait. So I've sort of added up those three verses along the lines of, Dan shall judge his people is his calling, to be able to discern and to make correct judgments, something like reigning again. But in reality he misused his abilities and his giftings simply to bite and to gain his own ends that way, rather than God's ends. And finally, a prayer. So calling, a reality, and it's the prayer, "For your salvation I wait, O Lord." Gad gets the smallest of the lot. "As for Gad, raiders shall raid him. He shall raid him at their heels." Now, would you believe it? In Hebrew, that's six words, and four of them are a play on the word Gad. Four of them are words that are playing on the word Gad. "As for Gad, raiders," or raiding band, "shall raid him. Gad, Gad, Gad. And he shall raid Gad at their heels." So, as I say, you've got the Jacob name there again. "As for Gad, Gadders shall Gad him, and he shall Gad at their heels." That's the sort of way it goes. It's a pun. Not exactly. Leah said, "How fortunate," and she named him Fortune. He does seem to go out of the picture quite quickly, so maybe he was just simply violated and everything taken from him. Difficult one. Verse 20. "As for Asher, his food shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties." Deuteronomy 33 speaks about the sort of richness of oil. Oil dipped in, he dipped his heel in oil, wasn't it? Deuteronomy 33:24. Which speaks again of prosperity and luxury. So much of it, you're walking around in it kind of thing, which is a nice picture of walking in the Spirit. But of Asher he said, Asher of course means happy or even blessing, "More blessed than the sons of Asher, may he be favoured by his brothers, and may he dip his foot in oil. Your locks shall be iron and bronze, according to your days, so your strength or your leisurely walk be." Deuteronomy 24 and 25 is Moses' blessing for the tribe. Again, it does speak, of course, obviously of luxury and prosperity and so much oil around that you can walk in it. "His food shall be rich, shall yield royal dainties." Why have I written down 1 Kings 4:7, I asked myself. Solomon had 12 deputies over all of Israel who provided for the king and his household, and each man had to provide for a month in the year. And about royal dainties, Solomon seems to be making sure he's got a bit of luxury around him, by the provision that's supplied. So perhaps Asher was pretty good at providing for the king royal dainties. Mind you, that's quite a nice thought, isn't it, really? That if you've got something good to give the Lord, something at his table to share with him. Verse 21, Naphtali is a doe let loose. He gives beautiful words. That's a fascinating one, isn't it? The thought that came to me was that in Matthew again, chapter 4, where it's Zebulun and Naphtali, there a light has shone. After quoting the verse, which comes from Isaiah, of course, it goes on to say, from that time Jesus began to proclaim the kingdom of God is at hand. So those are some of the words, perhaps, that we should bear in mind. He gives beautiful words. And it was in that area where there were beautiful words. The kingdom is at hand. A doe let loose, of course, speaks of beauty and ease and life and freedom. What about Judges? Oh, yes, that's why I put Judges, because it's Deborah, isn't it? In Judges 4 and 5, where Deborah executes that judgment and then sings about it, Naphtali comes into the picture somewhere. Verse 10, Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali together to Kedesh, and 10,000 men went up with him. Deborah also went up. So they were the main volunteers in the war, in the fight under Deborah. That was Judges chapter 4 and verse 10. They constituted the main part of the army. And in verse 14, from Ephraim, those whose root is in Amalek came down, following you, Benjamin, with your people. From Machir, commanders came down. And from Zebulun, those who wield the staff of office. So there's a further reference there. There are a number of the tribes are mentioned, those who came to the battle and those that didn't. But Naphtali was one of those. Well, these little ones are rather fascinating. Let's have a look at Joseph. This is the longest one. It's longer even than Judah. Joseph is a fruitful bough. A fruitful bough by a spring. Now that word fruitful, of course, is a play on the word Ephraim, which was one of his sons, and who's already been blessed by Jacob. So Joseph is showing forth his life in Ephraim, who is a fruitful bough, is a fruitful person. Its branches run over the wall, which probably means that it's going way beyond its own origins and home and offering itself to the Gentiles. The archers bitterly attacked him and shot at him and harassed him. His bow remained firm. His arms were agile. From the hands of the mighty one of Jacob, from there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. From the God of your father who helps you, and by the Almighty, that's El Shaddai, that's Shaddai, by the Almighty, who blesses you, with blessings of heaven above and blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breast and of the womb, blessings of your father, have surpassed the blessings of my ancestors, up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph, and on the crown of the head of the one distinguished amongst his brothers. Well, that's a fascinating one, isn't it? The one distinguished among his brothers, is the word separate is used in the word distinguished there. One separate from his brothers. You may have that in your version. But it comes from the same root, it's the same root as Nazarite, a separated person, on the crown of the head of one separated. Obviously, Joseph was all those things, both separated from his brothers, and he was also distinguished from his brothers. But it's the fascinating development from being attacked. I think verse 23 and verse 24 are probably reflecting in a very colourful picture form the experience of Joseph. The archers bitterly attacking him, shot at him and harassed him, is surely the reflection on the way he was treated by his brothers and sold to the Ishmaelites, thrown down a pit, pitched into prison. They kept on attacking him bitterly and shooting at him. Don't you feel sometimes that the devil is rather spiteful and bitter and just goes on and on at you. And if you've seen a few advances against the enemy and one or two victories in people's lives that you've helped or prayed for, he does not like it, and he comes and hits you, and he tries to shoot at you, these archers attacking him and shooting at him. And you remember, the archers usually in scripture are talking about tongues or words, and the arrows, the flaming darts of the evil one in Ephesians. And so the enemy's attack is seen there. So here is a fruitful Joseph running over the wall, giving fruit and blessing to people beyond his immediate circumstances. The devil hates it, and he's shooting back and shooting at him and harassing him. But his bow remained firm and his arms were agile. That is another commentary on the way that, again, in this highly colourful picture, not in a literality but in a metaphor, that he stood his ground and he refused to give in. Even when he was forgotten and overlooked by the butler, he still stands there and his bow remained firm and his arms were agile. I am not going to give in. And you stand against these attacks from the archers, from the hands of the mighty one of Jacob. Now, is that at that point an acknowledgement that it was not by might, not by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord, that the strength that Joseph was able to stand by was from the hands of the mighty one of Jacob? The mighty one is a very powerful description. The mighty one is of Jacob is, of course, using the idea of the God of your father or the God of your fathers. And at this time he's called the mighty one of Jacob. There are verses probably in your margin that pick out that mighty one as a name for God. So the mighty one is holding us and giving us strength through his hands. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. Well, from where, you might ask? It certainly doesn't refer, presumably, to Joseph himself from that line, because Joseph's line does not produce the Messiah. But it might refer, therefore, to Jacob, from there, from Jacob and from the mighty one of Jacob, is the shepherd. In other words, there is going to be a Messiah, a shepherd. It's coming from Jacob. That's the nearest antecedent, anyway. Rather than thinking about it as a place, it was a person. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. I don't think anywhere before this is the idea of Israel and a stone mentioned. There's the idea of a pillar, of course, and he put his head on a stone. But obviously, where later on you've got a development, but I was thinking about what it would have meant at this point when Jacob is saying it, and then thinking, of course, of these lovely prophecies that this stone the builders rejected, and the stone which is the head of the corner, the stone which is the capstone. And there I see in the margin here, they're all mentioned. Psalm 118, Isaiah 28, 1 Peter 2, 6-8, they're all places where you've got this Jesus referred to as the stone. For there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. I wonder why shepherd and stone would be put together. It's as though he's building his house, his church, he's building the fold on for the sheep that he's shepherding. So for looking after the sheep, he's the shepherd. For providing a provision, for providing a fold or a place of safety for them, he is the stone that the builders rejected, or is the stone of the corner. Yeah, and he looked after sheep, of course, when he was with Laban. Yeah, well, it could come from his experience as being looking after sheep and his experience of setting up pillars. Verse 25 is another name given. For the God of your father who helps you, and by the Almighty, that is Shaddai. El Shaddai is one of the titles given to God. Shaddai, it's been discussed, and an older view was that it comes from the word Shad, which is breast, the many-breasted God, as though he is provider. But that's slightly questionable. From the God of your father who helps you, and by the Almighty who blesses you, with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep beneath, blessings of the breast of the womb, blessings of your father, has surpassed the blessings of our ancestors. Is that six times altogether? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times. And to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills, may they be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of the one who is separate from his brothers or distinguished from his brothers. So those are many blessings, and they are on the head of. I always thought it was rather a quaint term, but there you are. Blessings be on your head. I suppose if you take in verse 20, the Almighty who blesses you, there's a verb, and then the nouns with the blessings, the blessings, the blessings, the blessings, and the blessings. That's six times blessing. Well, it looks as though he's looking in every quarter possible to get blessing, doesn't he? He's looking to the deep, and he's looking to the... There are things like the blessings of the womb, and which obviously is life, springing forth life and children. The blessings of your father would be the blessings that were promised to Jacob, and presumably, therefore, it's as near as we get in Joseph to that standard phrase that you get with Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, that in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. And here you've got the blessings of your father. That would be, in you all the families of the earth will be blessed, and I will bless you. First time I've noticed that, but it's fascinating, because I've often asked myself that after the three patriarchs and then Israel begins as a nation, you don't get that little phrase in the earlier stages anyway, being passed on. But here is as near as you get it, I would think, with Joseph. The blessings of my ancestors and the blessings of your father, they are yours too. Why would the blessings be on the crown of his head, I wonder? May they be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of the one distinguished from his, among his brothers. Where do you want to put blessings? On the head. Yeah, the blessing of the Holy Spirit and the oil of the Holy Spirit. And then finally, Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he devours the prey, in the evening he devours the spoil. Just seems to be the ferocious, ravenous spirit of the Benjaminites being referred to. But it does show too, perhaps, that the favourite son is not always the one that needs to carry all the good things. It does show that Jacob is not being partial. I say the favourite son, perhaps Joseph was back in that place, but anyway, we know that Benjamin was certainly well thought of and looked after by Joseph. Last few verses then, all these 12 tribes of Israel, and this, that what their father said to them when he blessed them, everyone with the blessing appropriate to him. And he charged them, saying, I am about to be gathered to my people. Death in the Old Testament is to be gathered to your people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite. And in that cave that is the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought along with the field from Ephron the Hittite for a burial site. There they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah. There they buried Isaac and his wife Rebekah. And there I buried Leah. It's what one has guessed, of course, because Leah is not in the list of people who went down into Egypt, that she'd probably died. But here it's mentioned explicitly for the first time. There I buried Leah, the field and the cave that is in it, purchased from the sons of Heth. And when Jacob finished charging his sons, he drew his feet into the bed and breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. Well, I'd like to go out like that, having blessed somebody, wouldn't you? I want to go out having blessed people. There's one or two that look more like a curse, but it's certainly trying to help them anyway, because you don't have to accept either a blessing or a cursing. You can always appeal to God. And this man has... He finishes up really with triumph, doesn't he? With all his fleshly ways and problems he created, he certainly has got there, which is encouraging. But maybe we can finish up with blessing.